Hey everyone, good morning. This is Andrew from We Were Gamers, and we don't normally record an intro piece for our podcast, but I had a feeling, or at least maybe a hope, that a lot of people would be joining us for the first time on We Were Gamers today to hear our interview with Mitch Gittleman and Jordan Weissman from Harebrained Schemes, which was freaking amazing. They spent a ton of time with us answering questions about everything about Battletech, as well as creating video games and starting their own company and their histories with the game and everything else. And they were really, really generous with their time. But it is a little bit of a long episode, and there is some intro stuff before our interview. So I wanted to let people know, if they were just here to hear our Harebrained Schemes interview, to jump ahead to the 29-minute mark. You'll miss some fun stuff about Hearthstone and Gwent and our normal intro stuff. But I don't want people to wait around if that's all they're here for. And of course, we wanted to thank Jordan and Mitch again from the bottom of our heart. They spent so much time and were really, really generous to talk to us for so long about Battletech. And I just want to mention off the bat that we were never paid or asked to be paid or anything like that to do this interview. We did it because JJ and I were both instant Kickstarter backers of this game. And having played the backer beta recently, it was just, we had to reach out and find out more about this game so we could bring it to people and tell people about it, because we really think it's going to be worth people's time. And yeah, you can still head over to the Harebrained Schemes website, by the way. If you listen to the interview, you like the idea of the game and you want to back it, they are still taking those, I think, through their webpage. And lastly, I do want to mention that we were super, super duper nervous this entire time, and that I did know in advance of this, and thus why we were so nervous, that Jordan created Battletech. Yes. I just was a nervous interviewer for the first time, and we didn't have the best introduction question for them. But yeah, I hope that everyone enjoys the episode, and there you have it. It's here.
Yeah. Wait, what's here?
I did for a long couple episodes there. I said we were going to do something special.
Yeah.
It was going to be a secret because I didn't know if it was going to happen quickly or not. And then I kind of like went quiet and mum on it because...
So we still didn't know if it was going to happen quickly or not?
Well, we had some, you know, people are very busy and they have very important things to do. And I don't want to blow it until we make the intro later, but
yeah, I think this is a momentous episode.
It's first for us.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, we'll get to that in a minute. How have you been, my man? I believe it has been like 3 to 7 weeks since we've talked.
It has been a while. Yeah, for sure. Maybe folks knew or didn't know or could tell, but some of those episodes that came out the last couple of weeks were pre-recorded. So this is, you know, Andrew, you know what has happened? Labor Day has come and gone. We are now in a, you know, a post Labor Day society. Did you get, you know, what does that mean, right? You can't wear white anymore.
Oh,
isn't that what it means?
Is that a thing? I need to change my shorts.
Isn't that, gosh, I really don't know. I thought that was a thing. That's the fashion thing, right? You're not supposed to wear white after Labor Day.
I think that you're right, yeah.
So, you know.
I don't know about if that's even true anymore. White is such an integral part of, like, modern design.
Yeah.
I mean, just everything is white. Like, I'm staring at my computer screen and 3/4 of it has white all, you know what I mean? And it's just, like, clothes are white and everything's white now.
I think the bigger problem for us living in California is that it's freaking hot still. And so I want to wear colors that are not going to cause me to boil. and so black shirts are right out.
I think when we were in high school, it was kind of the opposite. It's just the exact primary opposite. Everything was black.
Yeah, I definitely wore a lot of black back then.
But, you know, like even design and computers and everything was black. I think the iPod kind of changed all that. The first iPod was white, and everyone was like, whoa, you can make things white that are cool?
And then you hold it in your hand, and it turns yellow very slowly. It's new.
We're not talking about the early days of plastic.
No, we're not.
How was your Labor Day?
It was pretty good. You know, we went to a little barbecue with some friends for a while. Had a good time there. And had a nice... Yeah, we specifically didn't have a busy actual Monday, and that was very nice.
You got a, like, siesta in there?
Oh, yeah, dude. There was naps. It was wonderful. I actually got to, like, sit and play some video games. That was pretty nice.
What?
Yeah, I know. We played some of the new Uncharted game. That was fun.
Ooh.
You know, just a nice, relaxing kind of, like, watched movies. You know, just had a good time. Caught up on TV shows. Really just a good, relaxing, no laboring weekend.
Nice.
How about yourself?
I and one of the girls and Katie drove up to Michael and Laura's wedding this weekend. So we left Thursday and drove all the way to Tahoe. Oh, yeah.
Friends of the pod, Michael and Laura.
Yeah, friends of the pod. They definitely deserve lots of congrats and hope they're having fun in Hawaii right now.
Awesome.
Us suckers over here on the mainland.
I know, right?
Dude,
we goofed.
So we left Thursday and drove up 395 and then got detoured because there was a major fire. eventually got there and Tahoe was beautiful and not crazy hot, and it was a fantastic, wonderful, beautiful wedding in the, you know, middle of some pine, or no, not pine, aspen groves.
Oh, wow, nice.
It was really beautiful, and then we drove back on actual Labor Day, so I labored.
You labored behind the wheel of a car for what? How long is that drive? 8 hours?
Well, if you are alone, slash only with adults, you could probably do it in 9.
Okay.
Maybe a little faster, but probably around 9.
By which you mean, like, if you were just driving full speed most of the way and only stopping for
gas
food.
Gas, and that's about it. Yeah. Okay. But with little kidlet in tow, you got to stop, and that's like 11 hours. Plus, we had to do some off-roading to get around some traffic.
Off-roading?
Yeah. We hit a traffic patch around, what was that, Mono Lake maybe, or Owen Lake.
Okay.
And there's little roads next to the freeway. So, you know, if you got some all-wheel drive, you just go around.
Okay. So, wait, you actually got off the road and were driving on a not road, or were just off the freeway on a separate road that was near the freeway?
Not like a paved road.
Okay.
Like one of those service cutout off-road rocky slash sandy things.
Gotcha. Okay.
Your BMW would not go on.
Right. Now, I know what I would do in that situation, and that's sit in the traffic. Okay. Nice.
Hey, you know, if it cuts off 25 minutes, it cuts off 25 minutes.
True enough. I was just trying to get the picture correct in my mind. I just imagine Andrew being like, I don't have to sit through this. It just like starts peeling out, doing donuts in the dirt and like flying over bumps like it was a dirt bike or something.
No, but did you see the new Ford Ranger is going to get a Raptor version?
No, I didn't see that at all.
Yeah, because you don't care, but
yeah, correct.
You know,
I'm not in the market for a truck, but I don't know, the Raptor version of the F-150 is pretty cool. I've seen.
Yeah, so a little smaller version of that.
Rad.
Yeah, I hope it's on Top Gear. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That would actually be really cool, but since they don't generally drive trucks.
No, and they should do trucks more because their audience is more American than British, let's be honest.
Well, there's just because there's more people in America than
Britain. when does Top Gear come back?
I don't know when Top Gear comes back. I think the Grand Tour is supposed to come back in the fall.
Sorry, you're right. That's what I meant because I don't care about Top Gear.
Yes. So if you meant the Grand Tour, I believe it's supposed to be the fall. Although but probably like the later fall. Since they haven't made any announcements or anything about when yet. So but the if you had been following the news about them, which I'm sure you haven't, Richard almost died in a car crash again And Jeremy Clarkson got pneumonia. So
how did he almost die again? Didn't he die in an explosion the first time? Car flipped over and he broke his leg?
Oh, wait, which... Are we talking about years ago when they were on Top Gear or like recently?
No, like recently he was in an electric car and it flipped over and broke his leg.
That's the one I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah. Okay, cool. But I didn't hear Hammond got pneumonia.
No, Clarkson got pneumonia while he was on vacation.
On vacation. Great.
Yep.
Great. Argle.
Yep.
Well, it is what it is.
Yeah. Well, you know, they live hard and die young, except Jeremy Clarkson's really old. I don't know.
Okay. Oh, well, before we get into the fun segment, I think we have some housekeeping.
Yeah, let's keep house.
They fixed something on Gwent that I want you to know that they fixed.
I love Gwent. What did they fix?
When you pick the cards in your pack,
mm-hmm.
It now shows you how many you have of that card and of the trio of cards.
Yes. The best change.
If you have like the animated version of a trio card in front of you,
mm-hmm.
It'll tell you have like zero, but underneath it's like a slash and it says 18.
So you knew you already had copies of all those cards.
Right.
In the non-animated version.
Right.
That's cool. That's good.
Yes. So that was like our major complaint about picking in packs is like, well, I don't know if I need to pick the animated version of this because I don't know if I have regular versions of this.
Yeah.
And so now for a regular card, if you get an animated one, it'll say zero, but then underneath it'll say three. And you're like, oh, I already have a playset. I don't need that animated card.
Unless you just want to pick the animated card.
Well, like, I mean...
If you have all of them, might as well pick the animated one, right?
Sure, yeah. I'm not saying you wouldn't pick the animated, but there's a chance, like, oh, I have none of that.
Yeah. That is... They made some really good changes with this last patch. Also, did you know when you play those cards that have the three separate pieces of art, now they rearrange themselves when you play it so that the art always looks correct?
Yeah. Yeah,
that's a good change. Cool. That's a good change.
That's one of those changes that Hearthstone would never get around to.
Or like one of those changes that they would have done in Hearthstone before they put the game out because their artists are like really like anal retentive about that stuff. They like really care about those weird little details.
Yeah.
And like that would have been something they would have started from the. It's like, oh, of course the art always has to look right. We're never going to allow it to go out the door without the art looking right. What?
Yeah. Well, Gwent is still in beta, technically. So.
It is. And they have said, like, they are... The reason they're making so many changes and, so you know, doing so many crazy things to it is that it is in beta and they want to try all this stuff before it comes out for real.
Oh, man. And, like, completely ripping Trio out of the game.
Yeah. Yeah, that ability. Just gone. And every card that had it now, it does something completely different.
Yeah. Or, so. Like, changing cards to be completely different or giving abilities from cards to other cards because they lost abilities.
Swapping abilities between two cards, basically. Like,
yeah, like Gidwenny Sargent and the guy that used to make the weather go away. Because took away the sergeant's ability and then they were like, he can get rid of weather now.
And then they gave that other guy the sergeant's ability, kind of, but not as... good, and it only works for certain guys, and like
yeah
it's really wild. Like the changes they're making are crazy. Like they changed a whole bunch of elf cards, and then they after the patch realized that like, oh, these weren't very good changes, the elves are way too good. And they put out a hot fix where they changed a bunch of elf cards again to like make them a little more fair. All the Northern Realms stuff is like really into armor all of a sudden. And like the armor cards are actually good and worthwhile where they weren't previously. That's
yeah,
cool.
Cards that they had like taken down the armor on, or they had taken away armor effects instead, and they like loosened up the play space and made it all about armor again by saying like, well, all this buffing baloney that was going on and the Reaver thing that was going on is done because it's just unbeatable with that card that like adds an extra Reaver. So no. And then here, have armor instead.
Yeah, and like then you get guys who take away your armor but get bonus to themselves, and you have the guy who pulls a guy out of your deck and gives him 5 armor, and a guy who just gains 2 armor every turn, and you could just, you know, do all these kinds of armor stuff, and then eventually all their cool spells that attack your guys don't do anything because each person on your side has like 5 armor.
Yeah, and they kind of took everything away that ignores armor too.
Yeah, there still is some of that, but yeah, not a lot.
Let's talk about the biggest change, and then I think we should move on.
Okay.
Golds.
Yeah, so now the gold card is no longer by default immune or whatever, resistant to any effects that don't specifically target golds. So you can just, a gold card is just a card now, except that generally its effect is really cool.
How crazy is that?
It's definitely a very big change.
It was interesting to have cards that were just kind of immune from effects.
It's sort of, I see what their intention is, or they're like, oh, you know, it kind of made the game uninteractive, right? Where it's just like, you play something, and then I play this gold card that screws you over, and there's nothing you can do about it. Ha ha. Like, it gives you even if that's not actually the case, it gives you the thought that like, oh, well, if I just like blow up this guy's gold card, maybe I can do something to come back in this game or whatever. Because like some of those gold cards get a lot of points. Like a lot.
But it's like, it basically hurt the monsters, right? And that was kind of about it.
I think it hurt everyone because gold cards can now be affected by weather and stuff like that. And also can be affected by buffs from your own stuff. So if you have cards that will like boost your every card in a row, the gold card gets hit now too. You know, that kind of stuff. So it's kind of a double-edged sword. But like I definitely have once again scorched my own stuff because I've forgot that the gold card's not immune. And so I killed my own guy and I'm like, oh no. All right. Well,
just concede. Yeah, Scorch is back to being a really good card again.
Yeah, the other thing that having the gold cards be more like normal cards is it makes you think a lot more about the number on the gold card. Whereas before, you really cared about how much power it had or what the effect was.
Like right.
What cool thing does it do? And the number was less important. Now I kind of like care a lot more about that number. It's like, oh, this has a really cool effect, but it's only like worth 4. And like 4 is kind of low.
Yeah, before also might keep it out of target range.
Definitely. But like I am thinking about the fact that I'm thinking about it rather than just going, yes, cool effect, put it in, is new, right? I didn't used to think about that number. And now I am.
Oh, okay. All right. Fair enough. Card games.
Yep.
One you're still playing that I saw some news on that I just am shaking my head as hard as possible.
Mm-hmm. Is that like a nope kind of shaking or just like a
I can't believe it's been this friggin' long and now we're talking about this type of stuff.
Yeah.
Hearthstone.
Yeah, Hearthstone. I'm playing a lot of that game still. I like it.
Oh my God. They're literally looking at Fiery War Axe now. How many years into this game? And they're like, no, maybe it's
well, let me list the entire set of cards they're changing in this upcoming balance thing. They're changing Innervate from the Druid basic set. They're changing Spreading Plague, which is a card from the newest set. They're adding 1 mana to that. They're changing Fiery War Axe. They're also adding 1 mana to it. They're changing Hex from Shaman, and they're adding 1 mana to it. And they're changing Murloc War Leader to no longer give health, to only give attack. So that is 3 basic cards, right? Innervate, Fiery War Axe, and Hex. 1 card from the newest expansion, and 1 card from the classic set.
Yeah.
See a trend there?
Yeah, I do, and it's kind of infuriating.
Yeah. I don't know.
We've lived with Fiery War Axe for 2 years. Just leave it alone and fix your game.
So they posted some rationale about like why they changed each card the way they did and what are some other things they thought about changing instead. I don't really necessarily agree with the way they chose to change Innervate. So instead of giving you 2 free mana, it gives you 1.
Yeah, I think our change was better. Our change of you can't go over your cap for the turn.
Right. So there's
was way better.
And they said that they had considered that version. And there's a like I think they said refresh 2 mana crystals, which pretty much implies exactly what we're talking about, right? You have to already have the crystals, and then you can refill them again. And that seems like a better version of that card than what they have now, because now it is just a coin.
Yeah, it's just a coin. Like, and, oh, look, they get a coin. Great.
And they're now not the only class that has that. Rogue has a card that is called Counterfeit Coin that literally is also the same thing. And then there's the actual coin in the game that is also that. So it kind of makes the card seem kind of weird. Like, why do you have this one card with a different name that kind of does the same thing?
I think they just, like, forgot that they wanted Druid to be a class that can manipulate mana. And so they, like, made too much mana manipulation. And
yeah,
then they tried to also make good cards that weren't just mana manipulation. Like, most of the games that I've seen where you, like, manipulate mana or you manipulate power and you get extra, generally the other cards you get is just like, okay, well, I have to flood the board with cheap cards because there's really nothing special other than just putting out cards, right?
Right.
And instead they were like, here's a bunch of really amazing cards that go with it. I'm like, well,
yeah, I can't do
everything.
I really think they should have considered changing Wild Growth instead of Innervate, or maybe in addition, because if you're talking about like cards that are confusing and don't nerf necessarily the way you might think they do, Wild Growth should be right at the top of that list. That card does a bunch of weird stuff compared to what the text on it is very simple, right? It just says gain an empty mana crystal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Except that that's not all that that card does. If you have 10 mana already, what it actually does is gives you this other random card that lets you cost zero and draws a card.
Yeah.
It doesn't say that on that card. It also right. doesn't tell you that the way the mana crystal works is it's not full, right? You just get an empty one. Does it say empty on it?
Yeah, it says gain an empty mana crystal.
Okay. It's just the card has a bunch of very strange interactions, especially with the what happens when it's full stuff. That
they say empty because they have other cards that add mana crystals, and they just say gain a mana crystal, and it's full. They don't say full. That's the problem with that.
Yeah, so it's just a little inconsistent, and that card is weird and also part of the Druid basic set.
Mm-hmm.
And Innervate, which has like a much clearer meaning, at least like, you know, from first reading, could have been made clearer if they had also chosen to change this one at the same time. But instead, they left it alone, and now it's just kind of weird.
You know, maybe we should have had Ryan back on to talk about this, because now I'm having a thought, and the thought is maybe they did too much, and Druid either needed permanent ramp or temporary ramp, but not both.
Mm.
Like, okay, Innervate stays the same, but there's no gaining extra mana crystals. You just get them each turn. Like, once you run out of Innervates and whatever else cards they come up with, like Wild Growth is 1 mana crystal next turn, or you know what I mean? Something crazy, weird. Mm-hmm. Or, okay, everything's like Wild Growth or that Jade Druid card where you're gaining mana crystals permanently, but they're empty and you're wasting mana to get them.
Yeah.
But not both, where like, okay, now I can catch up.
I think the real thing is that they finally printed a card that allows Druid to just draw a ton of cards. Because the thing about running Wild Growth and that Jade one that gives you more mana and Nourish for the same reasons are that like these cards are great and they let you accelerate your curve, but like you're sacrificing a card for them. So you know, if you go first, you only have 4 cards in your opening hand, and one of them is Wild Growth. Okay, well, you play Wild Growth. Now you're down to 3 cards. You still haven't done anything, really. And your opponent now has 5, you know, and can start, you know, beating you in that kind of, like, card attrition war. If a bunch of your cards do nothing, essentially, by the time you get to 10 mana and you draw Wild Growth, it's just a completely dead card.
Right.
And so, you know, paying 2 mana to cycle 1 card from your deck feels real bad.
Yeah.
Unless you have something like Auctioneer or whatever. But and so when they finally printed a card like Ultimate Infestation, which draws 5 cards, it completely counteracts that issue of like ramp up and then you get to the top but have nothing good to do there except draw 1 card and hope that it's worth the speed of getting there, right?
Right.
There you go. And, well, now it is, because you get to 10 mana, you draw 5 cards, which is, you know, a large portion of your deck, and then all of a sudden you can just vomit whatever creatures you find out on the board next turn.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying, is if it's one mechanic or the other, and you get to that point, that's maybe more balanced than being able to do both.
Yeah.
Or you can have both, but your options in terms of what creatures are going to come out of your deck aren't as good, because that's just the, you know, limitations of the design. You can't give someone everything is the problem, right?
Yeah. And I think that that exact phrase is why they also decided to change the Fiery War Axe.
Yeah, but weapons in general have always been a mathematical problem, right?
Yeah.
For the mana cost, the damage per turn is correct, but the damage overall is not, right? Like the 5 mana for 10 damage or whatever it is, the weapon, or the 5
warrior one?
Yeah, what's the 5 mana weapon that they have?
Arcanite Reaper?
Yeah, so that's 5 mana for 10 damage, right?
Yeah, it's 5 mana for 5 damage, and then next turn 5 more damage.
Okay, but so 5 mana for 5 damage is not great. 5 mana for 10 damage is great, and that's what you're actually getting.
Right.
And that's always been a problem with every weapon, including Fiery War Axe. So I just understand, like, we've understood the conceit of this space is that weapons are really good, but you know, you have to take damage to use them, basically.
So I think the issue is that with Fiery War Axe costing 2 mana, to be clear, the change, they moved it to 3. That's all they did. Sure. It costs 3 mana now. With Fiery War Axe costing 2 mana, it was, bar nothing, the best removal card in the game, period. It was essentially 2 mana for 6 damage over 2 turns.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, like, that's really, really, really good.
Yeah.
And you would take very little, if any, damage at all, because the minions are removing on turns 1 and on turns, you know, 1, 2, where you'd be playing Fiery War Axe, generally have very low attack values also. You might take 2 damage if you're unlucky and the person played a very aggressive minion.
Sure.
So the downside of it is basically zero. You know, you take 2 damage, which you heal in your 1 hero power later in the game. And the upside is you kill the entire board presence of someone in the very beginning of the game immediately. And there's kind of nothing they can do about it. Like, there are no 4 health minions you can play anymore, except in wild, on turns 2, really.
Yeah.
So I see where they're coming from with regards to it being too good. When you make it 3 mana and a 3-2 weapon, all of a sudden is really not appealing, because there are other 3-2 weapons for Warrior that have effects, and this doesn't.
Right.
So the card is straight up now power creeped by other existing cards.
Yep.
And that kind of feels bad. And, you know, it's like Hunter has Eaglehorn Bow, which is now also better than this card for 3 mana. It puts Warrior in a weird place. And Blizzard said, you know, they sort of did it because they want to have more options for Warrior at these lower levels or whatever. And, like, maybe that's true, but obviously we haven't seen it yet. And I just have to hope that in the next set or the next couple sets, they start giving Warrior some early game stuff again, because there's really no early game cards for Warrior that you want to play anymore. Like, it's desolate out there.
Well, it's interesting because they just keep finding more and more ways to remove people playing things like Pirate Warrior and all that sort of stuff. And forever, people will always find decks that they can run things like Pirate Warrior. And if they just keep removing more and more and more and more early game, like, turns 1 and 2 are just going to be abysmal for every class.
Yeah. Yeah, it's tough because, like, this nerf does affect Pirate Warrior, like, very badly.
Yeah.
Like, that class used this weapon in an aggressive way, and, like, in some ways it was, like, kind of the staple of the deck. Like, that weapon is so good that having it would, you know, give them a turn 5 kill versus, you know, a turn 7 kill. That's a big difference. And, you know, so this nerf hurts that a lot, because now that deck really has nothing good to play on turn 2, pretty much at all. Like, there's one good play on turn 2 in that deck, and that's only if you get a certain turn 1 play. that gives you a weapon, right?
Right.
So, you know, it was good in that it hurts that deck, and that deck is kind of bad for the game because it's too aggressive and probably too powerful. But, like, how did it get to that point? Like, maybe you shouldn't have printed all these aggro cards that, like, jump out of your deck and attack you with charge and, like, a bunch of stuff. I don't know, you know?
Yep.
I continue to be hopeful for that game, but, you know, before these changes, the ladder meta in that game is in a real bad place where, like, druids are literally all of the things, and then you have, like, some pirate warrior aggro stuff on the side, and the druid aggro stuff on the other side, and that's kind of it. It's, like, druid aggro, druid midrange, and druid jades, and then pirate warrior, and that's kind of it. It's not a good place to be.
Right.
So hopefully these changes will shake that stuff up somehow. I'm hopeful.
All right. I think that we've kind of discovered we need another full Hearthstone episode with Ryan. That went a lot longer than I thought.
I'd be down to talk with him some more.
It's time for us to shift gears here. All right. It's time to let the cat out of the bag. We're going to do a little intro here, and then we'll cut away, but we're going to do an interview, JJ.
Yeah, and...
a legit interview. Not that I haven't enjoyed interviewing all of our friends of the pods about all sorts of stuff that they know more about than us.
Right, and I think these people certainly know more than us about some things, but they're also professionals.
Yeah, yeah. We've talked a lot about... we spent multiple episodes on the game Battletech. And we had the wherewithal and the idea that maybe we should ask some people that know more about Battletech than us what's up with Battletech. So we're going to interview some people from Harebrained Schemes.
The creators of the new forthcoming game, Battletech.
I'm really excited. I'm really nervous. Are you nervous? I'm nervous. I'm going to talk until I stop talking because I'm nervous.
I'm feeling a little bit... nervous, yeah, a little bit, but I'm also really excited. Like, these people are really cool. I've really enjoyed, and I know you have also really enjoyed a bunch of the games that they've made.
Yeah,
and not
Shadow
just
Run
the Battletech
series.
Stuff. Yeah, there's Shadowrun games they made were awesome, and you know they've been putting out great stuff on the PC for several years at this point. And I just want to pick their brains and get inside and find out what they're up to. So.
I can't imagine that once this full Battletech game comes out that I'm going to be having much time for anything else given the modes and what we've already played. So
oh my god.
If my life is going to get sucked down that kind of hole, I need to talk to the people that are going to ruin it.
I think that's perfect.
Okay, so we'll be right back with our interviewees from Harebrained Schemes. All right, we're back from our little break here, and we have Jordan Weissman and Mitch. I have no idea how to say your last name, Mitch.
Well, why don't you just give it a try and see what happens?
Gittleman.
All right.
Okay, come on. You could have tried. Could have tried harder than that.
Gittleman.
Yeah, there we go.
Gittleman.
Right on. Yeah. I'm just messing around. It's great to have you guys both on. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for doing this. I don't know if we can express enough how much fun we've had with the Shadowrun series.
Oh.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yeah, and I don't know about you, JJ, but I'm nervous to talk about Battletech because I am insanely excited for this game. And having been both backers on Kickstarter and playing the beta, the expectations are really high. You guys, I don't know if you know how much fun you've already put into the game.
Well, our job here today is to lower your expectations as much as possible so that when the game comes out, you actually like it.
Oh, okay. Okay, cool.
I mean, I remember when I was a kid, I ruined Star Wars like that for several people.
Just telling them how awesome it
was. It was been, I had built it up so much that it could never live up to the expectations. So that's our job.
Okay.
You know, so lower everybody's expectations.
Cool. We'll bring it back down to Earth here. Can you give us a little bit of a background for just a second about... go back and remember maybe your first interaction with Battletech. Like, how did you hear Battletech was a game out there that you wanted to be a part of? Because I remember pushing around pens and paper and not really knowing what we were doing, but that Mad Cat model was mine, and I knew that I was going to blow things up.
Well, that question has to go to me since Jordan created BattleTech. So he didn't find it. He actually made it. So the question is, how did I find Jordan, I guess? But yeah. Is that a question you really want answered?
No. Well, stick to the game.
Exactly. The game. My first interaction with BattleTech was Battle Droids and playing tabletop with my friends.
Where'd you find it? Was it at a con or a game
store? No, it was at Tom Dowd's house, actually. Tom Dowd was one of the original designers of Shadowrun. Did he work on BattleTech besides Mech Commander 1?
No. Okay. He joined as part of the Shadowrun team.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. So, yeah, I was playing with a guy named Mike Nystel who wrote the MechWarrior RPG, I believe.
Ooh, I think the first one.
Yeah. And so I was playing, but he wasn't writing the MechWarrior RPG at the time because it didn't exist in the concept of MechWarrior being an RPG.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, it was just Battle Droids with a group of actual game developers who we all lived in the same neighborhood and we used to play a whole bunch of stuff. In Chicago.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and my first encounter with Battle Droids was when we got it back from the printer.
Jordan, obviously, it's a little bit more of a complicated story with you, but I think our question was not maybe obviously your first encounter with BattleTech, but moving from having created this system and this series of games and then deciding it's time to reclaim the heritage of this and bring it into a video game space. Were you nervous to like re-encounter the origins of BattleTech and bring it over to video games?
Well, you know, BattleTech and video games have been synonymous and connected at the hip very early in the game's history. I mean, I think the first game, which was Crescent Hawk's Inception, which we did with the Westwood Studio and published by Infocom, was like in 87 or something like that. It was like early, like mid 80s. And so like, the game had only been out, BattleTech had only been out like 3 or 4 years at that point. So, and that was, you know, kind of an RPG, a tactical RPG, and then Crescent Hawk's Revenge. And then, of course, we went on to the MechWarrior series.
Right.
So, I mean, I was making BattleTech, involved in the making of BattleTech video games for a long, long time. And then, you know, we did the BattleTech Center and the Virtual World Center, and that's where Mitch joined us. And you want to tell him what you said when you had your interview, Mitch?
Not really, no.
Oh, now we have to know.
I don't really want it on the internet anymore. But originally, Jordan and I were talking about me coming on to work on what was eventually Crimson Skies. And we developed that. But during the interview, I said, just listen, just don't put me on BattleTech. And he said, why? And I said, because I hate BattleTech, Jordan. It's stupid. Which is a great thing to say during a job interview.
With the creator of it.
Yeah, well, we had a relationship, if that helps. But for some reason...
I then made him make BattleTech games for like 20 years.
Yeah, that's the funny thing. About 3 months later, I was on BattleTech.
But he came to love it.
No, I did come to love it because I thought of BattleTech as just giant stompy robots, which I felt was incredibly limited. And I hadn't had the interaction with the BattleTech lore and BattleTech history and BattleTech fiction. And then it was years later that I really started to appreciate the BattleTech fan base.
When we started this one, it was I hadn't made a BattleTech game in almost 15, 16 years since the last BattleTech.
So
it had been a long time, and actually that was great because I was able to. We're just really excited about getting back into that world, and very excited about going back to turn based. So it was good to have some space.
So it's been 15 years, right? Why is it time to bring back BattleTech, especially given kind of like the IP lapse and the completely different playstyle from Shadowrun?
I'll tell you my answer if you don't mind.
Go for it.
Because we got the chance. Because the truth is, I mean, Jordan and I have been talking about BattleTech since we started Harebrained Scheme 6 years ago. We always wanted to do BattleTech. It was just a matter of getting the license from Microsoft.
Mm-hmm.
And we were finally able to do that thanks to the good graces of Phil Spencer, who really is supportive of us.
Yeah, and I think, you know, once that was opened up, then it was really kind of how do we want to do it and what's the right – what's the game we want to make? Because Mitch and I have both made a lot of video games in the BattleTech universe over the years, yeah. right? Yeah. From, you know, the original Crescent Hawk's Inception, which was a, you know, turn-based RPG, to the MechWarrior series, to Mech Commander, to Mech Assault. I mean, we've been all over the spectrum.
Even our Twitch show, Death from Above, on yeah. Hyper RPG, that's just another BattleTech game we've done.
Yeah, and I think what we were excited about was kind of going back to the roots of the franchise, mm-hmm. where you're, you know, you're commanding a lance of four mechs, and you're doing it in turn-based, which gives you the ability to really dive into detail with the management of the mech and the heat and the stability and the pilot. And those are things which, when you're in real time, you kind of have to move higher level, right? You can't have that level of tactical control. And so, turn-based gave us that opportunity. And we thought, since we're going back to the roots of the franchise, we would go back to the kind of the inception point of the fiction. And start at the 3025 era, and then have the, you know, if indeed people like the game, have the ability to move through the timeline and introduce all sorts of the cool new stuff over hopefully the upcoming years.
So we're starting pre-Clan Invasion, right? So
why, 30 years before the Clan Invasion,
right? So. Right. So why in this era another Mercs title? Why not try and pick a pre-Clan faction, like, you know, to
one of the houses or.
To play as, or did
well. One of the great things about BattleTech and MechWarrior is that people really have very deep passions and kind of associations with the different houses and the different clans.
Right, go Steiner.
And one of that's one of the great things. But it also means, though, that if you pick one of them, let's say we did the game from the point of view of House Garita, you as a House Steiner fan are slightly miffed off.
Yeah, right? Good point.
Okay.
And we wanted to do it in a position that was kind of neutral to that effect, but yet gave you the opportunity to demonstrate your loyalty to a particular faction. So okay. If you start as a mercenary company who is independent, right, your backstory and everything supports that, your position supports that. And then if you are a House Steiner fan, well, then you can really build up your reputation with House Steiner and become kind of one of those, you know, kind of permanent mercs like Wolf's Dragoons was for House Davion for so many years, you
right,
know?
Good point.
Yeah, that was definitely an exception. Yeah. This game takes place in the periphery, right? So those different, you know, major noble houses have presence in yeah. the periphery, but it's not like you're driving through the inner sphere.
Right. You're not getting invited to lunch with Melissa or Hans or, you know,
maybe have some cake.
Yeah. You're not at that level. I mean, I think that's also one of the reasons that we put it in the periphery was, you know, you're starting as a small, unknown, broke mercenary unit. And, the big guys aren't going to be, you know, lining up to give you contracts. Oh, right? You got to earn your butt.
I was really hoping to get a Davian Steiner wedding invite.
Well, it's something to work your way towards.
In another game.
Yeah,
in a game that comes right hopefully after this one. So you start, you know, playing with and being employable by the kind of petty dictators and pirate lords and you know, kind of in the old Cold War vernacular, you know, banana republics that are down in the periphery, and you get really embroiled in that and start earning your bones. And as you do so, then the representatives of the houses who are bucking in that area, you know, you start to become interesting to them.
Oh, cool. Did you, given the expansiveness of the BattleTech world, like, I mean, the books, the previous games, the IPs in Microsoft, all the people that have touched it, was there any time or when you were putting this together that you had like a problem with a mech or a character or anything that you really wanted to see in the game that you had to work around, or is that just not a problem?
Well, there were, let's just say, as you said, there has been a lot of people who've touched it, and so many people have done fantastic creative work and contributions to the universe over the years, both on the, you know, authors and game designers and fan sides. And there are occasionally things which, in retrospect, you wish weren't there.
Oh, okay. So not just stuff you couldn't get a hold of, but stuff maybe you couldn't really fit anymore.
Well, there were some bird aliens.
I was going to say, yeah, there's like some sentient birds that were written into one novel that we were, yeah, we were like, okay, we're not going anywhere near that.
Okay.
you know, those became kind of they became the kicking boy.
The troubles of dealing with a shared universe.
Yeah. Awesome. Do you mind if we switch into a little bit of the technical questions on the beta? Because as Kickstarter backers, we played a decent amount of it. And I think we had some questions about some design choices in the game and maybe where things are going.
Yeah, Mike McCain's not here, so we can blame him for anything.
Oh, okay, yeah, he's perfect. The game director.
Yeah.
Well, we'll keep it on a overarching design level rather than a down to nuts and bolts.
Yeah, anything you like, this was our idea. Yeah. And any problems are clearly McCain. So let's roll.
Okay.
So the mechanics obviously seem very close to the pen and paper RPGs. Was that always the plan? It seemed like when we were talking about you bringing BattleTech back, that was the plan. But was it supposed to be referential, or was it supposed to be more?
Yeah. Were you trying to make BattleTech the pen and paper game a software product, or were you trying to do something a little different?
The fact that you think it's so close to the pen and paper product means I think we achieved our goal, because in reality, you know, almost every major underlying mechanic system is different than the tabletop.
Right.
Our goal was that it should feel like your memory of the tabletop did, mm-hmm. right? And that your tactical expectations, your memory of how a mech performs, should be all true and valid in this game. But the underlying mechanics of the tabletop game are 35 years old. And even as a tabletop game, you know, they're not very modern in terms of sensibilities. But tabletop games also have a very difficult time translating successfully into good computer games. Things that are different. One, you're not at a shared table with friends, which is enormously impactful on how you review the quality of the evening's entertainment. Right.
Oh, good point.
And the second part is you're not rolling dice, and the act of rolling dice has this inherent drama to it, which a random number generator on a computer does not.
Right.
So, for example, if you roll boxcars, if you roll 12, it's like, all right, I need a 12 to hit, and you roll 12. You and your friends are on the table and go, oh my freaking God, I can't believe you got that. The computer doesn't do that. The computer says you have a 99% chance to miss, and you happen to hit. It's like, and nobody goes woohoo.
Yeah, you don't take the shot, right? Because your computer told you you shouldn't.
Right. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And so yeah, there's the drama of the die roll is very, very different, and then also kind of how time plays is really different, right? And how you can absorb information when you're at the tabletop and everybody's rolling dice and clicking stuff off. You've got plenty of time to absorb all of the different things that are happening in BattleTech. Because these are very complex characters, right? Each mech has, you know, 11 different armor locations and up to, you know, on the big ones, you know, more than a dozen weapon systems, and then the pilot and their capabilities and their stability and their heat. It's just a bucket of information. And in a computer game, it can become very overwhelming to kind of track what's happening. And so because for all those reasons, we've done all sorts of subtle manipulations with the mechanics to make that play as a modern computer game, but yet feel authentic to the tabletop game.
So, like, what is some of the stuff that when you guys were looking at the tabletop game? Like, give me a few examples of stuff that. You know, I maybe played one or two games of the tabletop game ever, and it certainly feels like a tabletop game that I'm playing here.
Yeah,
but obviously it isn't, right? Like, this is a computer game. I have my mouse and keyboard. So, like, what is some of the stuff that you guys saw the tabletop game were like, okay, this is the kind of stuff we don't need here, really, and these are the sorts of things we want to put
in. It's not so much the won't need. It was more, what's fun and how do we translate the game? So one of the big things, you know, we did a lot of prototyping of turn order. We tried at first to do simultaneous action, all sorts of stuff for the game. And our lead designer, Kiva McGinn, came up with this idea of this, a new turn order.
The initiative order-based system.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause I think the old BattleTech tabletop had kind of simultaneous, it had initiative-based movement and simultaneous fire.
Right. And so your imagination plays that out, which a computer, that's a little more.
Right. And so we tried prototyping that in a bunch of different ways, and it was always just way too much information overload. And also, to your earlier question, there were things that the tabletop game didn't successfully simulate for us. One of the foremost of that was the medium and light mechs didn't really have unique roles. They were just kind of smaller versions of the bigger mechs, which meant they just died.
You wanted.
Yeah, in the fiction they did, right?
Right,
in the fiction they were scouts and they were flankers and their agility really mattered.
But in reality.
Yeah, in the tabletop that just didn't come across. So we were really, that was one of our design goals, was to really make sure that that happened here. And that's why we were playing all these different turn orders and initiative systems. And the one that we settled on, really emphasizes that flexibility yeah. of the smaller units. And I think gives them that ability to play those roles. And so, that's an example of the kind of place where we would stray, but try to keep the essence of the universe in the game forefront.
Yeah, but it seems like the players of the beta, maybe you guys can tell us, but appreciate that work, especially for the light medium.
I think that the most recent update definitely gave the light mech more than just the ability to run out and take a hit or two. I don't know if that was your experience, JJ, as well, but when the beta first hit, my experience of like the commando running out was, okay, he's going to either hide the entire game and then come out for call shots, or he's going to run out and take some hits for my heavy mech. And I think with the pilot ability change, especially adding more abilities for those guys to run out and be able to do some damage without just getting blown up the first 2 seconds, was a real nice change for those mechs.
Have you played much with reserving your units?
Yeah, I have. And maybe, JJ, what are your thoughts on the reserve sequence? Because I ended up actually reserving my heavy mechs more than my light mechs.
Hmm. I actually just was playing a light skirmish last night. And because I hadn't really, like, I wanted to have, like, the fun stuff was always the heavier mechs.
Sure. Who doesn't want to shoot off everything on an Atlas?
I want the Atlas, right? Everyone wants the Atlas. And so, I played a light versus light game, and that like gave a completely different feel to the combat. It was really...
Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah. That's and awesome. So it was cool to go, okay, it's like, well, I have one guy with initiative 5 and one with 4 and then a couple with 3. So maybe it actually makes more sense for me to take this guy who's like clearly twice as fast as most of the other mechs out here and reserve him down to 4 so that I get 2 actions in a row.
Yep.
Whereas before it would be like shoot once and then they move and then I get to shoot again. Being able to shoot twice in a row, especially if you could line up a knockdown or something the turn before, it makes a big difference.
Oh yeah, the bigger the mech, the less flexibility. So your heavies you can only reserve for one. Your assaults you can't reserve at all because they move last no matter what.
Right.
Yeah.
But if you've gotten your lights into a nice defendable position. And you can reserve them all the way down to, one, then they can flank, get a rear shot, on the Atlas. And then, you're back at the top of the turn order and they go again. And so they could either get a second shot,
or they can run
away before they get hit again. Yeah. So that's the kind of, dynamic we were trying to enable that wasn't there in the original tabletop.
I actually hadn't thought about that, where if you just reserve all the way down to 1, you're guaranteed to go, and then you'll start over again at 5 or whatever and go again before them. So that's like almost close to like 3 times in a row, right?
Well, it's 2 turns in a row, but you got to set it up right, because if you're just standing out in the open waiting, reserving, you're just going to take
yeah,
shot
you'll just get blown
shot
up.
Shot.
Yeah, of course.
but if you kind of use the guys in the right way, keeping them hidden, keeping them flank over the side, then sweep out, get 2 turns in a row can be really powerful. Especially, if you're dealing with like if you got a guy down, right? And then being able to get 2 called shots in a row, or stabilities, his, you've shaken up his stability or worked his earlier units have worked his chevrons down, and so that he's you know, evasion, his evasion chevrons down, so he's easier to hit. You know, he can really take advantage of that stuff.
I think that the game has always, since the first playable portion, felt like we're talking about now, very tactical and very technical, with precise decisions you can make, like facing and cover and whether you're going to stand behind this rock and in the water and all those sorts of things. Especially with the new update, thank God for the line of sight eye.
Yes. Oh, yes. Thank you so much.
Best change. We knew that we needed that. We just didn't have a chance to get it in, you know, when we did. So we had all planned for that.
Is there anywhere else in the game? Because sometimes when you finally, you got everything positioned and we're all lined up in a battle line or whatever, I run out of tactical decisions to make once in a while where you're just like, well, we're all just going to stand here and pound each other with lasers. Is that kind of a design choice to say, okay, well, on this map, everyone's going to hit the river at a certain point and my LRMs are on the hill and my heavies and assaults are in the river and that's what's going to happen? Or is there still some technical changes you want to see to add more movement and tactical choices once you hit these choke points?
No, there's, first of all, we don't plan these maps to say, okay, at this point on, you know, turn 10, we expect it to be like this. It's more about, we want our multiplayer gameplay and we want our single player missions to last about this long, right?
Okay.
Which is why we made some of the decisions we made on Melee and how it works, right? So that our missions play out in a reasonable amount of time. So that's one thing, but also don't expect a lot of tactical changes to the game here. We're still, you know, analyzing beta feedback and stuff like that, but we don't have some big sweeping new features we plan to put in.
Right. But the biggest one is not a change to combat, but the change to the context in which combat will
be
played.
Well, right.
So right now in a skirmish game, there's really, you know, if you feel like you're in a decent position, you're just going to sit there and take the damage as you deal it out.
Right, because winning means I have a mech and the enemy doesn't have any.
Right.
There.
When you're in the context of the campaign, and every one of those hits is costing you money. And it's going to cost you time to repair.
Right.
Right. Now, all of a sudden, standing still and just taking it feels a lot less attractive.
If you're a mercenary, you lose a mech in a mission, that's really, really, really bad. Right? Taking internal damage is bad. Losing a mech in a mission is going to cost you big time. And, you know, money is a very important thing to lose.
Yeah.
And a game developer.
Yeah, unfortunately, the mercenary simulator is a simulation of, you know, running a business.
It really is.
Everything costs time and money.
Mech tycoon.
Yeah, kind of. I like that.
Yeah. Yeah, there is a sense. Yeah, we may use that. But yeah, so like you take damage of a mech, or when one of your mech warriors get wounded, and you return back to your dropship, and the Argo, you know, your mech tech's going to look at it and go, okay, yeah, that's going to take me X weeks to put that thing back into, you know, back up to 100%.
Mm-hmm.
And the doc's going to tell you, yeah, that mech warrior's going to be in the infirmary for, you know, a month.
Okay, so that definitely opens up some spaces that maybe we didn't quite understand in the betas. I've asked before to JJ while we were playing, hey, so my guy just took, my pilot says he's hurt. What does that really mean?
Right.
Yeah, it means that. Why do I care? Means that the on the next time you're doing a combat sortie,
you're replacing him or her with somebody else.
They're not available, right? And if you can take that mech out of the mech bay and put it back on the field before it's finished being repaired,
you could.
But then you'll be out there with whatever armor holes in the armor and whatever internal systems not back online yet. So yeah, those things, you know, they have kind of longer term impact. So it does change the way you play the combat game when it counts.
Gotcha. Now with having run this on Kickstarter, I know that you've done a few Kickstarters before. does it affect the plan or the scope of what you're putting out there, like through a beta like this, to show people too much at once? Or do you feel any pressures that maybe affect game, maybe not design, but at least release?
It always comes into play always. We are always attempting to balance the needs of the project with the needs of our audience, who through their good graces have allowed us to make the game, right?
I ask it because we're talking about such a technical game, right? Like you're saying, there's stuff in the here that we don't even understand yet because we don't have the campaign.
There's a ton of stuff you haven't seen.
Right, right. So does that give you like a crazy feeling of pressure or anything?
No, we have a crazy feeling of pressure at all times. You know, just doing a Kickstarter. Well, first of all, game development is nuts, right? And it's a really, really, really competitive and stupidly hard business. But if you take that out of the equation, then we are making a video game in a glass fishbowl where there are people sort of knocking on it, on the fishbowl, to see if we can get the fish to dart around a little bit and sort of entertain it.
Yeah, you're not supposed to tap the glass, right?
Yeah.
You put up the big sign that says, please don't bother working.
Yeah. So there's that element too. And trying to please people, you know.
Yeah. And then also the fact that, you know, like we talked about with Shadowrun, you know, we're playing with childhood memories here and we want to honor those, you know?
Right.
And honor people's investment, emotional and time investment into the franchise.
And we take it extremely seriously. Yeah. That responsibility.
Yeah. So, there's a lot of pressure there. But Kickstarters do change the way you approach development because it's
backwards.
Yeah. Up front, we're committing to what the game's going to be at the end. And so it's, you know, and all games is like all creative works. They change, they evolve, over time, and through development. And so, you know, I think one of the things that the Kickstarter audience and especially our audience, which has just been enormously supportive through all of our experiences with them, has come to understand that. And so when we come out and say, hey, this feature, which, you know, we mentioned the Kickstarter, you know what, we tried it and it's not fun, or it's, you know, we've spent so much time on X that it's no longer in scope. You know, we just kind of play open kimono and tell people what's going on. And they've been enormously supportive. But that doesn't mean there wasn't the pressure there to try to make it all work like we said it was all going to work.
Yeah.
Right. You even changed game engine mid-process. Does that expectation of game longevity for expansions, for sequel, obviously you can't really speak to all that.
I think that's actually a mistake. We never changed game engines.
Oh, really?
No, no. I think what you may be thinking about is
Shadowrun.
No, but for this game, what happened was, I think what you may be referring to is, we had intended to put out a multiplayer beta much earlier in time. Mm-hmm. And what we realized is that we had gone down a path that was not viable for shipping. And so we had to pull back and re-architect our multiplayer, but it doesn't have anything to do with changing engines.
Oh, okay. Got it.
No, we've never changed engines. We've been fully committed to Unity on this project.
Okay. Unity, you went from Unity 3 to Unity 4, is that right?
Oh, that part, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
There was an upgrade.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
It was 4 to 5.1 or whatever.
Yeah, that kicked us in the teeth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, actually, my nuts are still blue from that one.
So is a change like that something that how do you decide, okay, we're in this Kickstarter mode, and we've got this change that could really affect the game. We don't know quite how. How do you sit with that decision?
Well, it has to do with what the upgrade actually gives you from a development point of view. And more importantly, not just gives you, but gives the audience. So in this case, with Unity, I think it was 5.1, it really changed how we could approach animation. And it had to do with, I believe, something to do with, forgive me, I'm not a very technical guy, memory allocation, stuff like that, and would allow us to have the game played on a far larger sampling of computers.
Oh, okay.
And that's a huge deal.
Right.
But I think the kind of guiding principle is, we need to do what's right for the shipping game.
Yes.
Right.
And that means that sometimes we will disappoint our backers for a period of time while we do the right thing for the shipping game.
Right.
What our backers have said almost unanimously
is,
you know what? We're okay with that. It's like, you know, make the game great. You know, if it takes a little longer, if it means we don't get this feature in the beta till later, it's okay. You know, what we want is the best game you can make when it comes out.
Because they want us to be successful and keep making more BattleTech.
Yeah, no kidding.
That's what I want.
I want that too, Matt.
I don't know if you guys can tell because you've made so many of these games now, but that's not really a design philosophy for AAA titles out there. Most of it is slap it together and get it out the door. Look at.
I disagree. Yeah. Respectfully, I disagree. I've been in this industry for 25-ish years, Jordan, you know, being ancient, you know, even longer. And I've interacted as a publisher at Microsoft with a lot of AAA studios. And I have never once in my personal experience interacted with a development team that had a let's just slap this together and get it out mentality. I've never ever seen that.
You're absolutely right. I don't mean the game actual designers and makers. I mean the publishing houses sometimes, EA, etc. It seems like they're ready to rush stuff out and not give the developers the time they need.
Yeah, well, it has to do with this thing called money.
Right.
And if we were smarter business people, we might have made very different decisions with our game development, too. Unfortunately, we just think of ourselves sort of as craftspeople. And the game needs to live on after us and support our goals for it. And we put that ahead of financial reward because we're dumb. You know, somebody like EA, who's actually in it to be a business, you know, they have to make very different decisions and hit their fiscal goals, and they're publicly traded.
I think that's all true. But I do think that there are differences at different organizations about, you know, what level of respect they hold their players and their fans in.
So I completely agree with that.
Maybe it's not respect. Maybe it's interactivity, right? Like, your communities are more tight-knit with you, I think, than maybe the Call of Duty community is with EA and their direct relationship with each other. And maybe that's what I'm talking about, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think that comes from two things. One, you know, coming out of tabletop games, you know, you were kind of always at a, you know, 4x8 table at conventions, you know, interacting directly with your players and your fans. And so that's kind of in our DNA. And then Kickstarter, you know, just reinforces that, right? It just meant that you know, that became the way of doing this business as well, which is, I think, one of the reasons that we've taken to it so much is because we've always loved that direct interaction with
Without
the audience.
Doubt. Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, I think that is true. Bigger organizations have a harder time with that. One of the reasons that we felt so comfortable with Paradox is because they are like that, right? I mean, they like us believe in always going the extra mile for, you know, for your players, for your fans, that, you know, having frank and honest and respectful conversations with them, is what you do rather than try to package information or talk down to them. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the reasons I think the relationship with them has been so positive, because we both approach that pretty critical, you know, culture thing in the same way.
Sure. And the other thing is, you know, that, for those larger companies, EA, they have a responsibility to their shareholders. We have a responsibility to our audience. We don't have shareholders right now because we're just little guys in a great big world.
And I think, you know, you said that you sort of think of yourselves as craftsmen, but would you think it's fair to say almost more like artists who are really passionate and really care so much about their work?
I see no difference.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, I don't see a difference. Passion is passion. For an artist or whatever, you know, we can get into the our games art thing, but certainly with the Shadowrun series, and I'd say with the story in this one, we are expressing ourselves, you know. But passion is everything for us. Craftsmanship is everything for us. Trying to do the very best work of our lives, every single game we make. That's what we're about.
And I think it comes across very clear in the final products.
Neat.
At least in.
I'll take it. I would prefer a higher salary, but I'll take that.
Oh, that's not true, actually.
I don't want a higher salary.
Well, you've made the choice many times.
I made the choice.
We've both made the choice.
Yeah. We had mega higher salaries, and here we are.
Is that why you have your own studio, right? In a way, you be able to say, these are the decisions we're going to make.
Without a doubt. You know what? I said to somebody in the studio just yesterday, aside from the our federal, state, and local government, rules don't apply to us. Right? And that is a glorious way to run a company.
Right.
Rules don't apply to us. You know, it's not about that.
I think we just have one super duper important question left. When you're sitting down with the version of the game that we don't get to play yet, and mm-hmm. you're ready to send out your lance on a campaign mission.
Yeah.
And you got everything set. You got your atlas. You the game's ready to go. What is in your highball glass next to you? What whiskey?
That is an excellent, excellent question. Well, Jordan, you want to take that one?
Well, I'm not a whiskey drinker.
Okay. It doesn't have to be whiskey.
So before I, you know, my advice to all of our mercenary, future mercenary mech warrior commanders, is that before you hit launch and you send your men into the teeth of combat, you take a moment and pray to whatever deity is important to you. Yeah. And then, you know, grab the mouse and go for it.
I was going to say, hold on to your both hands. But yeah. And for me, I'm a bourbon man.
Okay.
And actually on my desk right now is not bourbon. It's Irish whiskey that a fan sent us. God bless. And it's, what has he got? Jameson Double Black Barrel or whatever,
ooh,
which I've been sucking on since I got back in town from Gamescom. But I'm a Basil Hayden man. And in the other hand is a Hoyo de Nicaragua cigar.
Oh, wow.
Which means, if you've been counting, he needs to use his mouth to drive the mouse because he's both.
Yeah.
He's, or some other appendage we're not going to discuss.
No, we can discuss that. Go there. No, but that's the good thing about it being a turn-based game. You can put the cigar in your mouth, you know, and hold it there.
You really want to have that feeling, like you were saying, of running the Banana Republic yourself. You have the cigar, you have the whiskey.
All he's missing is a pair of sunglasses.
Exactly.
Right on. Well, we want to thank you both for an extreme amount of your time today. I don't know how to express how much information I think a personal like connection to the game that you guys were able to explore with us today. And I really appreciate it.
It's our pleasure, man. Thanks for backing us and thanks for all the support.
Yeah. Thanks for backing us. Yeah, that's really awesome.
Otherwise we wouldn't get to make it. So yeah. We deeply appreciate the support, both financial and emotional, the audience has given us. We're looking forward to some upcoming updates for multiplayer and continuing to make that better.
Yeah. And to show you more of the single player campaign eventually.
We were warned with a cattle prod earlier not to ask questions that couldn't get answered, so we steered away.
Yeah, we have handlers, you know.
Yeah, yeah. No, thank you guys so much. We really, really appreciated it.
Yeah, thank you so much.
It's our pleasure. Thank you for
really
playing.
Great talking to you guys.
Holy cow, that was fun.
That was a lot of fun.
I don't think I've ever been more nervous in my life. I would have really been helpful to be in the room.
Yeah, I really get a feeling that they're just like fun people. They loved, like Jordan especially seems to love to talk. and I would love to just sit in a room and shoot the breeze with them for, you know, an hour or 5 hours.
Yeah.
But thank you again.
They do have work to do. They have a company, you know?
Yeah. I guess being your own boss comes with the problem of having to do more of your own work.
So again, thank you to Harebrained Schemes for giving us a little bit of time with Jordan and Mitch. You can follow their Twitter account at WeBeHarebrained, I believe is correct.
Yep.
And obviously they have tons of BattleTech updates on there as well. I believe you can also on Kickstarter sign up for backer updates, which usually are fantastically full of information if you're curious about those as well. As far as we know, the game is slated for 2018. So not much more info out there than that currently. And
and hey, if you just want to get a taste of some of the stuff they've done in the past, those Shadowrun games are available all over the place.
Yeah.
Go play those. I have played them and love them. So.
I'm almost certain, too, that you can still do the lowest backer level through an email to them if you want to get your hands on the beta, if it sounds interesting, all that sort of stuff. Go ahead and head over there to their website and send them an email. And yeah, like you said, the Shadowrun games are awesome. Cool, man. Well, I don't even think we have time for fantasy football, do you?
I know. That's how crazy this year has been. Fantasy football has started. We did a draft, and there is not time to talk about it.
Nope. Next time.
Next time.
All right. Well, man, if people have questions that maybe they want us to forward on or something like that, where could they find us, JJ?
If they want to ask us questions about BattleTech, you can hit us up at facebook.com/wewergamers. We have an email that is podcast@wewergamers.com. Send us any questions there. We would love to answer them or talk with you. We have a Twitter account and an Instagram, both of which are @wewergamers. And let us know what you think. We would love to hear from anyone and everyone about almost anything. Almost.